Hello, and welcome to the Wealth Management Invest podcast. I'm your host, David Bodimer. I'm with the wealthmanagement.com editorial team. Today, my guest is Tony Davidow. Tony is a senior alternatives investment strategist with Franklin Templeton Institute. Tony, welcome to the show.
David, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So before we kind of get, you know, I've got some questions I want to pick your brain with, but before we get into that, why don't you just take a moment to, you know, tell our audience a bit about your experience. I mean, you've got a long track record in this industry, so folks may be familiar with you already, but for anybody that's not, if you could just, you know, give us a little bit about yourself and the work that you're doing right now.
Yeah. Thank you. And I think when you say I have a lot of experience, I think it's code for I'm old and I've been doing this for a long time. But thank you so much. Yeah. So I've been in the industry for over 35 years, beginning my career working for family office, spent a significant portion of my career working at Morgan Stanley, where I ran a number of businesses, including our institutional consulting business and our private wealth business, what we referred to at the time as Greystone Consulting. Then later spent time as a strategist with Guggenheim and Schwab. And, you know, after working so many years, I wanted to have my own company. So I had my own company where I was primarily developing alternative education programs, worked with a number of large providers, and Franklin Templeton had approached me to build out an alternative education program for the wealth management community. So I was originally hired by Franklin as a consultant. And I think along the way, Franklin recognized that this is a journey, this is a long-term commitment, and they really wanted somebody who was constantly putting out content and constantly engaging advisors as the discussions are evolving and advisors' understanding of the ever-changing alternative landscape was changing. So my role now, working for the Institute, is really thinking about the world from the advisor's lens. So I'm writing, I'm speaking, I have a podcast series, and I'm really trying to help advisors think through how to allocate appropriately to this complex world of alternative investments.
And so if I'm not mistaken, the announcement about joining the Institute was actually almost exactly a year from when we're talking right now. Is that right?
That's right. And again, prior to that, I was a consultant developing right. The alternative education for maybe 9 months. So yeah, it's been a nice trip.
And so what are your learnings, you know, in this period?
Yeah, I think we have to be honest that we as an industry don't always make it easy for advisors and investors. And sometimes the jargon we use is a little bit confusing. So we try to simplify. And as we talk about alternatives, really focus in on the role that each one of these types of strategies play within a portfolio. I think one of the things that's been interesting over the last couple of years and why we think this is a unique time to be having these discussions is the evolution of products, and in particular, I would say interval and tender offer funds, which now make some of these strategies available to a broader group of investors at lower minimums and greater flexibility.
Right. So it seems to be, it's very noticeable. I get press releases probably, you know, at least once a week at this point, somebody launching a new interval fund or somebody meeting some kind of fundraising threshold, not just interval funds, but the non-traded REITs, the BDCs, the tender offer funds. It seems like there's a real movement around the use of this structure and some of these structures and the advantages that they allow for the wealth management space. Is that right?
I think that's right. And I think we've really started to see it over the last couple of years. And there's a reason for that. One, I'd argue these are somewhat of a hybrid structure in the sense that they certainly provide more flexibility to individual investors, which is where most people focus their attention. As I said, they're available at lower minimums. They're typically available accredited investor or below. So there's a larger universe of investors who are eligible for it. But I think the other side of it, which is, I think, equally as important, is the institutional marketplace and those institutional managers who have historically brought these products to the market only for institutions and family offices are starting to recognize the interval and tender offer fund structure in particular provide protections for them. And it actually is appealing because they understand the wealth channel is a viable market and it's a real opportunity set. I think historically there had been a little bit of a hesitation for institutional managers who thought retail money was hot money, meaning that they were in today and out tomorrow. But I think the new structure provides them a little bit of protection so they can have illiquid investments, they can think long-term, allocate capital long term. So it's really kind of a win-win all around.
Yeah, and some of this also seems like it's been triggered by the performance of the 60-40 portfolio, specifically maybe a couple of years ago. It did better again last year, but you know, I think that that experience probably still has people thinking about what the right asset mix is and whether private and alternatives, however you want to call it, is a good piece for people to be having as part of their allocations.
I think that that's right. And David, I think you and I probably spoke about the 60-40 portfolio after 22 when stocks and bonds were both down double digits. I think it surprised a lot of advisors, and I think it surprised a lot of investors. And we have long argued that the 60-40 portfolio is an incomplete toolbox. It really served its purpose very well early on because it really taught investors about the value and the merits of a diversification. But it's an incomplete toolbox because the assets are much more correlated today than they were two decades ago. And we've done some work on looking at correlations rising. And now that you do have access to private equity and private credit and private real estate, why wouldn't you avail yourself of that? So I do believe that advisors now are recognizing, if I have access to these better and broader tools, shouldn't I be using them in building portfolios? So again, much of my focus is really focused on the portfolio construction side, not so much why to have private equity, but how to have private equity, how to allocate appropriately, what role does it play, where do I source the capital from, and then ultimately, when I put it in a client portfolio, what's my expectations?
And you know, the benefits at this point include a lack of correlation, greater diversification of your portfolio. What are some of the other benefits that you point out for folks?
Yeah, and I think it's important, and maybe even just to define a little bit how we think about alternatives. So I think most of the attention has clearly focused on the private markets, and the private markets include private equity, private credit, private real estate, infrastructure. Hedge fund strategies are often grouped together. And then I think that the third bucket is something that we refer to as alternative instruments, which are crypto and digital assets. But I think for most advisors, the attention and the focus is really on private markets. So maybe I'll just start there. So as you point out, part of the advantage is the diversification. They don't necessarily respond to the same market fundamentals. Historically, private equity, private credit, and private real estate have delivered a pretty significant illiquidity premium, excess return that you get for tying up capital for an extended period of time. I think that's part of the appeal, right? If I can get excess return, I would certainly take that, especially if we think equity returns are going to be more muted in the future. Private credit and private real estate have historically also provided higher yield. I can pick up incremental income in my portfolio by allocating to different resources. And real estate, interestingly, has actually provided negative correlation to both stocks and bonds. So where traditional investments, the correlation has been rising, for private real estate, it's really quite a different beast. And then the last ingredient that I think a lot of advisors forgot about for a few decades is correlation, or not correlation, but the inflation. Inflation has been rising, and we need to think about what types of investment can do an effective job in hedging the impact of inflation. Real estate serves as a very effective hedge. So if we think about it, they're really multifaceted tools that can be used differently in different portfolios to provide different sorts of outcomes.
And is the real estate hedge against inflation primarily tied to the fact that leases have like inflation kickers in them or things like that?
That's a big part of it. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And again, the ability to kind of adjust rates as rates go up, you can easily adjust for that.
So what is, you know, where are we in terms of the market embracing the use of these? Education, adoption, what is happening right now? Are there still folks that are resistant? Is this becoming more generalized? Where do you see things?
Yeah, I'd argue we're still in the early innings. You know, it certainly varies by advisors, and I suspect the folks listening to this call, you know, fit into multiple buckets. Some who are sitting on the sidelines trying to figure out where and how it's appropriate for clients. Those who maybe are dabblers have a small percentage in client portfolios. Maybe it's a 5% portfolio allocation or 10% portfolio allocation. And then those who are very proficient and have been using alternatives, they've been having good experiences, and they bring those to the clients, and they're probably 20 to 30% allocation to alternatives. I take a step back and I look at the industry, and David, you and I have been doing this for a long time. I think the industry has roughly been between 5 and 6% allocation to alternatives for the last decade. And as much as we hear a lot of noise around it, the allocations are a little slow. And I understand it. I think advisors are trying to be careful and thorough and really understand it well, understand the merits of the asset class, understand the nuances of the product structures. And then they start to have discussions with clients. But it isn't necessarily, you know, you jump in with 2 feet day one, just because, again, the terminology is often confusing. So I'd argue we're in the early innings. I don't know if that's the third inning, but it's certainly not the eighth or the ninth inning. I think as an industry, I think a lot of the folks in the space, and we're certainly at this view, aspirationally, we'd like to get the industry average to somewhere like 15 to 20%. And that recognizes the fact that some clients are going to have exposures to 30 to 40% if they have the wherewithal, if they have the sophistication, and if they're willing to commit capital for an extended period of time. So I think we're early. There's a lot of work to be done, but I think this is a unique time, and we're starting to see a sea change where advisors are really paying attention.
And on the back end, how much is technology playing a role, or the structures that we're talking about in terms of just making this all easier, like easing the subscription process, easing the reporting process, you know, the plumbing, you know, for lack of a better word, for to make this all, how does that play a role in this process?
It's a huge issue, and I'll just go back to my time at Morgan Stanley. And this was kind of in the early days. We really didn't have any technology, and everything was, you know, the data was imported. We literally had a guy on our team whose responsibility was reading the 53-page offering memorandums to determine whether the investment was right and appropriate for individual investors. So firms like iCapital and Case have really provided a tremendous value to the infrastructure, providing a lot of that plumbing and the wiring. And really, I think, especially for the independent community, have really helped them a lot to kind of think about how to get exposure and working through one of those firms. They now have a more elegant way of getting exposure. They can leverage the due diligence conducted by those firms. They can leverage the fact that they're looking at all these strategies on an ongoing basis and help them curate and create a menu. So I think we're definitely at a unique inflection point. And I think one of the big barriers had historically been that operational clunkiness. And we're still dealing with some issues, but I think we're definitely moving at a much more rapid rate. And I thank the folks who are really helping making that a smoother transition.
Yeah, and the structures, again, like, you know, these interval fund, tender offer fund, it seems part of the benefits of them are include the tax reporting is on a 1099 instead of a K-1. There are the no capital calls, and there are these like liquidity sleeves. You know, these are obviously supposed to be illiquid investments, but providing some level of liquidity does seem like it's important, you know, just as a peace of mind, or for, you know, for folks that need it.
Yeah. And if I can, maybe I'll just pick up on that last point, because I really do believe that advisors should lean into this whole illiquidity premium, right? You're going to be rewarded if you hold it for the long run. But if you think of it as a mutual fund where I'm in today and I'm out tomorrow, you're not going to get that experience. So if you invest in private equity, and a big part of the motivation is you want to capture that illiquidity premium, but you don't hold it the 7 to 10 years, you're likely not going to get the same experience. The other thing I've argued, and I've written a paper, I think I probably shared it with you, David, on the cost of being too liquid, because I do think that is the biggest impediment for advisors. I actually, you know, went through and laid out the case for it, and really suggested that advisors may want to think about developing an illiquidity bucket with their clients. In the early stages of the development of the relationship, shouldn't they be asking the question, how much of your capital are you comfortable committing for an extended period of time? And maybe for a high net worth investor, maybe that's 10 to 20. And from that, you're actually now, I've developed an illiquidity bucket. That's truly long-term capital. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to teach investors to think long-term, and we're trying to teach them to say, that's a portion of my capital that I'm not going to touch for 7 to 10 years. If the investor feels a little awkward about the market and the volatility, they can be more tactical and defensive with their liquid assets, but at least it instills that long-term discipline with them. And I think that's something as an industry we really need to lean into rather than shy away from. You did mention these quarterly liquidity provisions, and I think that's a really important thing. I tend to think of those as safety valves. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's some unforeseen circumstances within a family's life and they need access to their funds, yes, they have those quarterly liquidity provisions. But I don't think they should go into it thinking, you know, hey, if I'm uncomfortable with it, I can decide and I'll leave the fund altogether, you know, a year from now.
Right. So, yeah, so it's kind of, yeah, getting more of a safety valve, but like really getting people to understand that the nature of the of these investments is that it's a long-term, this is not something that's going to be fluctuating on a daily basis, that the strategies that the asset managers are executing are long-term strategies that have certain goals for a longer time frame, not necessarily like something that you can log in and see every day.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you still find that there are, you know, people that are very dismissive of doing anything here, or is everybody, or do you think it's more that people are really trying to grapple with it and think about it?
Yeah, I don't find a lot of pushback, people saying, gee, I don't think that it makes sense to invest in the private markets. I think more than anything else, I think both advisors and investors are really trying to understand how to, and what they're trying to understand is, you know, do I understand the structure appropriately? How do I get in? Does the underlying manager have the experience? You know, have they historically run private equity funds so they know how to source capital, put it to work? How do I distinguish between one fund versus the other? They all sound the same and use similar sort of language to describe their philosophy. Are the underlying holdings the same? How do I distinguish between one and the other? More of those due diligence type discussions for the more sophisticated advisors. But I think there is this sea change going on. So I think there's less of a pushback. I don't think they make sense. It's more of how do I use them appropriately? And if an advisor believes that, you know, they should be closer to that 20% allocation, how do we get them there over time? And one of the things I always say is, you really need to make sure that the client understands it in advance. So maybe aspirationally, your target allocation is 20%, but you may incrementally need to get their 5% allocation today. And maybe I invest in real estate because it's easier for our clients to understand. And maybe as they get more comfortable, I increase my allocation. And I think about private credit because it's a little bit more conservative. It certainly makes more sense in today's market environment. And maybe again, as they get more comfortable, then I think about introducing my private equity. So there's a way that you can leg into the allocations over time. And, you know, the hope and the expectation, I think, for the industry is the more the clients have good experiences allocating to alternatives, the more comfortable they will be in allocating capital in the future. And at the end of the day, we'd argue it's a really good experience for the individual investor. Adding alternatives increases the likelihood of achieving their goals. It's a really good outcome for advisors because it really is something that can't be commoditized, and it really speaks to their specialization, understanding their clients well, being able to distinguish between the products that are available in the marketplace. And ultimately, I think it helps the industry because it really takes us on a different sort of path.
So in terms of just learning about in terms of advisors, like learning about everything that's happening, you know, that's part of what you guys are doing with the FT Institute, with events and content. Can you talk a bit about what your programming is like, and also, you know, other ways that advisors can be trying to get up to speed?
Yeah, I think it's a great question because I think, you know, again, advisors should enter into the space and really have a full awareness of what's going on. So again, at the Franklin Templeton Academy, we have modules that are built for all levels of sophistication, from the basics, why alternatives, to deeper dives on private equity, private credit, private real estate, hedge funds, infrastructure. We have more advanced presentations, typically the sort of things that I write about in white papers and in market, where I'm meeting with groups of advisors talking about how to build better portfolios. We have a whole series of white papers on building better portfolios where I use case studies to illustrate the impact of adding them. So it's not just that theoretical discussion, add it because it's good. I'm going to show you what happens when you add it percentage allocation to private equity, private credit, private real estate. Those building better portfolio white papers and in-market presentations have been very, very well received from advisors because it's more the how-to, it's tangible, it's relatable. And then we also produce a outlook. We produce a 2024 outlook in early February. We'll do a mid-year outlook. And really what that's trying to do is give a capital market lens to what's going on. So where do we see the most attractive opportunities over the next couple of years? Of course, we're not suggesting advisors be tactical, but we want to at least give them a sense of which strategies we think will perform well in a given market environment. And we think that helps them having those discussions with their clients about why private credit looks attractive today, why the disruption created in 2023 with the collapse of SVB is actually an opportunity for private credit managers to fill the void because banks won't be lending in the same way that they have. So we try to triangulate and really think about how we can engage advisors at all levels of sophistication and all levels of medium. So whether it's a formal training program, whether it's deep dive white papers, I mentioned earlier, I have a podcast series where I interview industry experts, and that's really digestible. It's all around allocating capital. Nobody's on there providing a commercial for their firm or their product. So we understand it's a journey, and we've committed to helping advisors understand however they consume information best.
And we'll have links to, if folks look in the show notes for the episode on whatever, however you're checking this out, we'll have links to a bunch of this stuff there. So just wanted to point that out. We've been talking for a good chunk here. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important to highlight for folks?
Yeah, David, I think way back when you and I were talking about this democratization of alternative investments, and maybe just to kind of bring everything together that we've been talking about for the last couple minutes here, is we believe this is a great time. You mentioned, you know, the challenge of the 60-40 portfolio in 2022. I think that was a little bit of an eye-opening experience for a lot of advisors. But we look at the environment today, we think there's three pillars that are really transformational. One is, I think the market environment is demanding a more robust, a more durable playbook. That speaks to the value of alternative investments. We think product innovation has made these investments more accessible to a broader group of investors than ever before. You and I know these were only available to institutions and family offices a decade ago.
Right.
And then the third pillar, and this is really important, is you need to have access to institutional quality managers. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't have somebody who's run a traditional portfolio and raised their hand and said, I too can run a private equity portfolio. You don't value securities in the same way. You need to have deep and dedicated resources that know how to source capital, that know how to put capital to work, and really have a long and distinguished track record in doing so. So you don't want a fly-by-night newbie coming to the market. You really need to identify those established institutional players, access them, understand the structure that they're bringing to the market. And at the end of the day, I think this is a win-win all around for the industry if done appropriately.
Yeah, I think it is really notable that like the kind of asset managers that you see, including Franklin Templeton, putting products in the space are pretty heavy hitters and who got a long track record, but maybe not in the wealth channel, but in managing these kind of assets.
Yeah. And I think that's important. I think it's really important that you have people who have the experience, know how to allocate capital. And we were talking about it earlier, those institutional managers who often shied away from retail assets thinking they were hot money. Now they're actually saying, no, I understand the value of the wealth channel. I think the structures that are available now allow me to invest capital for the long run, even though we've got some better liquidity provisions for individual investors. So I think the institutional managers are bringing products on a regular basis to the market. And I think that's a good thing for the overall industry.
You mentioned that we'll have some links in the show notes, but if you also just want to, where's the best place for folks to find you?
Yeah, so I feel like I'm kind of everywhere, but I think the easiest thing for advisors to access their information is go to Alts by FT, mm-hmm. And go to the Knowledge Hub. And in the Knowledge Hub, we've got white papers, blogs, podcast series. You can sign up for the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast, and you can follow me on LinkedIn, where you know we publish podcast blogs. I think I'm posting something every week. But my singular focus is really to help advisors have better discussions with our clients and really understand this ever-changing landscape. So I never talk about products. I'm always focused at how an advisor should be consuming and using this information. So I'd encourage folks, you know, definitely take advantage of the resources we're providing. We're not the only one, but I think we do it very well.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that. I've definitely learned a ton listening to your podcast and reading your work. So it was a real privilege to get to speak more with you today.
Oh, David, thank you. Thank you. This has been great.
And David, how do people get in touch with you if they have more questions for you?
You can also find me on LinkedIn and also wealthmanagement.com. And you can find me on X or Twitter or whatever we're calling it these days, but sort of not posting there as much anymore. But yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. And thank you for listening today. Please like, follow, and share this podcast with your friends. Until next time, I'm Wendy McConnell.